light up your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm psychic medium Christopher George, and I have a new show that will air the first Friday of every month from 11 to midnight Eastern Standard Time. The show is called Insight with psychic medium Christopher George. It's all about psychic readings. I welcome my listeners to call in for a free reading. Just remember, don't ask me a question that you really don't want the answer to. I'll give it to you the way the spirits give it to me. Straightforward and real. The first Friday of every month. Insight, 11 to midnight.
Welcome, everyone, to A Global Focus with guest Nick Redfern, full-time author and journalist and specialist in unsolved mysteries. We will be discussing Nick Redfern's latest book, The Pyramids and the Pentagon, the government's top secret pursuit of mystical relics, ancient astronauts, and lost civilizations. Two of Nick's websites, nickredfern.com and nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com. Welcome, everyone, to this August 24th, 2012 edition of A Global Focus with featured guest, Nick Redfern. A Global Focus is broadcast on 107.9 FM New Orleans and the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Guest details can be found at the show website, aglobalfocus.com, and many thanks to Joe Montaldo, owner of the network, for making these programs possible. Nick Redfern, our featured guest, is a full-time author and journalist. Nick specializes in unsolved mysteries and has written several books in the mystery and adventure, paranormal, UFO, and ET-related fields. As a freelance feature writer and journalist, Nick Redfern writes regularly for several publications. Nick's journalism has appeared in the British newspapers, the London Daily Express, the Western Daily Press, the People, the Express and Star, and the Planet on Sunday as a full-time feature writer, Fate, and the British magazines The Weekender, Military Illustrated, I Spy, The Unopened Files, The X Factor, and UFO Magazine. Nick also undertakes freelance research as a consultant to the entertainment world, including TV production companies, such as Britain's Mentor in TV, Red Star Films of Canada, and the United States Sci-Fi Channel. Nick has appeared as an interview guest on many radio and internet programs and presented at several conferences, including the 1998 and 2001 Laughlin UFO Congress, the 2004 Mutual UFO Network Conference, the Aztec UFO Conference 2003, the 2004 Texas Bigfoot Research Conference, and the UFO Crash Retrieval Conferences in Las Vegas for years 2003 through 2006. Nick served as a featured speaker at the Paradigm event in Houston this past July. This autumn, Nick will be speaking at the Paradigm Symposium, October 18th through the 21st in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Tonight's discussion will include Nick Redfern's latest book, The Pyramids and the Pentagon, the government's top secret pursuit of mystical relics, ancient astronauts, and lost civilizations. Nick Redfern's websites can be found at nickredfern.com and nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com. Nick, thank you so for joining us this evening. I had the opportunity this past Wednesday to read your latest book. Boy, you presented several items of new information for me and interesting concepts.
Oh, well, thanks, Trace. I appreciate it, and thanks for having me back on the show.
My pleasure. You know, Nick, your books always hold true to your ability to present the sense of inner and mystery in these field topics together with a great deal of new information. I'd like to underscore here to the audience your professional researcher techniques using witness interviews, vetting material and witnesses, also your use of FOIA requests to obtain key information.
Well, I always think, you know, I appreciate that, thank you, and I always think it's important that, you know, when we're dealing with controversial subjects, that it's important to be able to get as much sort of backup testimony, documentation, and just verifiable information to present to people because, you know, we all know that there's strange things going on out there, but unfortunately, you know, we always have to deal with the skeptics and the debunkers, and I think the best way to deal with them is to present to them hard evidence or significant information that is, you know, hard to knock down or irrefutable. So that's why, you know, I always feel it's important to get as many sort of documentary sources, backup sources, corroborative data, because, you know, it just looks more professional when we're trying to, you know, explain to people what's going on, that when they can see there actually is, you know, it's not just reliant upon some Mr. X source or something like that, you know. So.
Absolutely. Confirmed sources. And also, yeah. Yeah, I just have to say that your work shows a great awareness of field information and also historical and archaeological past and present developments. And you discuss the new trends in scholarship in both the UFO and ET fields, but also as well archaeological and historical discussions now that are ongoing. Nick, you know, before we begin this great discussion, because I can't wait to ask you questions about your book. The point was fascinating. Nick, I just wanted to note that in a great interview on westcoasttruth.com that you had told the audience that your father served with the British Royal Air Force as one of the trained military people on the radar. You note that there were several incident radar trackers were picking up these fast moving objects. Could you tell us something about this?
Yeah, sure. My dad was in the British Royal Air Force, and he was worked on radar. And he's stationed at various bases over the years, but in September 1952, he was stationed at a base called RAF, that's for Royal Air Force, RAF Nettleshead, which is on the east coast of England, just sort of bordering the North Sea. And on three occasions, on subsequent nights, three nights in a row, the radar trackers at the base picked up these very fast and high-flying objects approaching the British coastline from the vicinity of Scandinavia, so Norway, Sweden, Denmark, that direction. And although these objects were traveling at sort of tremendous speeds and heights, the first thought was, with it being the Cold War still, it must be the Russians launching some sneak attack with some new weapon. And so fighter planes were sent from a nearby Air Force base called RAF Coltisol. And the pilots reported seeing these strange balls of light and sort of very brightly lit objects sort of zipping around the sky. And they basically tried to give chase, and these objects would just sort of shoot away, almost like taunting them, because they'd shoot away at high speed, then stop as if to allow them to the planes to catch up, and then they'd shoot away again. And it was almost like they're playing like a game of cat and mouse and circling them, etc. But there was no sort of overt hostile action or anything like that. And on every occasion at the end of the night, the planes had to return to base because they were literally running low on fuel. You know, they were going to drop out of the sky if they stayed up there any longer. So this went on for three nights. It was never really resolved, and everybody was taken into a room and told, you know, you won't talk about this. You've signed the British military's Official Secrets Act, which basically prevents employees from talking about sensitive data that they might have picked up during the course of their service. And my dad didn't tell me about this till I was about 13 or something like that, 13 or 14. And it sort of really got me interested because, on the one hand, you know, it was my own dad. On the other hand, he was somebody trained in radar with the military, so he knew what to look for on radar screens, you know, and to look for sort of false reports and shadows and things that, you know, that radar can occasionally pick. For example, a lot of people don't realize that if it's a very sort of dense thundercloud, a radar panel can actually pick up, you know, like a very charged cloud. But, you know, trained radar operators are designed to know or taught to know the difference. So, you know, the fact that he had this background in the military anyway, that, regardless of that it was my own dad, you know, he was also able to verify from his position with the military that this was something out of the ordinary. And I mean, he doesn't sort of dwell on it, but he, you know, he still talks about it to this day if people ask him. And, you know, he basically say, well, you know, we picked something up. We didn't really know what it was. And so by definition, you know, they are UFOs, or they were UFOs. And that's sort of what really got me interested. And I think people in the UFO field, they do sort of gravitate towards it for two reasons. Either they have a profound experience themselves, or they know someone who's had a significant encounter, and so it was the latter. You know, I've not had that sort of personal exposure, but, you know, the, with my dad's case, that's what sort of got me interested and sort of on the trail, if you like.
You know, thank you so much for those details. And boy, to me that will be a wonderful motivation to become the expert researcher you have become. And before we start this, my interview questions, I just wanted to note how very much, Nick, I appreciated hearing you speak at one of the last, probably the penultimate one, the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas, when you were describing some very important cases, particularly one in Wales that had occurred some years back, and also anti-gravitic technology. Very impressed. And also, lest I forget, I just wanted to let our audience know that they had the opportunity of hearing Nick speak this October 18th or the 21st at the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And if I'm not mistaken, the website for that is ParadigmSymposium.com. Boy, it sounds to me like a wonderful conference. I'd get to hear Nick speak there. Now, Nick, back to your book. Mm-hmm. And it has so much scholarship and interesting concepts on it. And again, it is the latest one, The Pyramids and the Pentagon, The Government's Top Secret Pursuit of Mystical Relics, Ancient Astronauts and Lost Civilizations. And details on that book and Nick's many other books can be found at nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com. Now, Nick, you know, it starts right off the bat, your book that is, with a possible CIA interest in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And, boy, these scrolls have been described as full of surprises by several researchers. And I had no idea, though, that you have a party from the Middle East approaching one of our CIA people wanting the United States to help transcribe the document.
Yeah, this is a very sort of strange story, because it goes back to 1947. And, of course, 1947 was an interesting year. It was the year the U.S. government passed its national security to sort of pave the way for the establishment in that same year of the CIA. It was the year of flying saucers when Kenneth Arnold sort of ushered in the whole UFO era, you know, and coined the term pretty much, flying saucers. It was also the year of Roswell, and it was the year that the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. Now, you know, you'd imagine that an intelligence gathering agency like the CIA would have no interest in something like the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's more something for like theologians, historians, archaeologists, people like that. But we know from on the record testimony from retired CIA operatives that for some weird reason the CIA was very interested in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this is sort of a theme that runs through the whole book about how intelligence agencies have taken a sort of a deep interest in the mysteries of the past. But the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls, basically, is that they were at a place called Qumran, which is on the West Bank in the Middle East, and actually found in a series of caves there. And they actually amount to almost 1,000. And they basically go back to about 150 BC through to about 70 BC. And, I mean, today they're actually ended up at a place called the Shrine of the Brook, which is an arm of the Jerusalem-based Israel Museum. And, you know, you can go and see them, and obviously you're not allowed to touch them, but, you know, they're on public display. Except at least for one scroll that we know didn't make it to the sort of official collection. And this is the one that fell into the hands of the CIA. And basically this story goes back to, again, 1947, and a man named Miles Copeland. And Miles Copeland was a senior operative in the CIA when it was set up in 47. And prior to that, he'd been attached to actually three different intelligence gathering agencies, the Strategic Services Unit, the Office of Strategic Services, and the Intelligence Corps, which are all sort of Second World War and immediate post-war agencies similar to the USA, to the CIA, that kind of got unified into the CIA. And Copeland said that on one particular day, he was working at the time at the CIA's office in Damascus, the capital of Syria, and the CIA's office was actually in the American Embassy building at Damascus, and he got a knock on the door one day, or the embassy did, I should say, and it was a man, sort of mysterious character in kind of like flowing Bedouin robes, who, acting in kind of like a very clandestine and secretive fashion, said he wanted to speak to somebody of, you know, authority, etc., about a secret, basically. And so he was brought into the building and directed to speak to Miles Copeland. And he basically brought out this sort of this thick robe, what he'd been hiding within this robe, this sort of large parchment, which basically sort of opened up into whole swathes of parchment containing ancient writing, some sort of Sanskrit-type writing. And this character said he'd like somebody to try and decipher what it said. Now, of course, this was actually just before, you know, the main set of Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, so nobody had a concept, really, of what the Dead Sea Scrolls were, because, you know, they hadn't been found. But nevertheless, what happened was that Copeland said, well, you know, I can have somebody look at it for an expert, you know, in ancient languages, but I have a colleague who is, and this was a man named Kermit Roosevelt, who was also deeply plugged into U.S. intelligence. And so what Copeland did was to take photographs of these scrolls and carefully sort of roll them all out, photograph each piece bit by bit. And this kind of satisfied this mysterious character who sort of crept out the door and said, you know, I'll be back at some future point. But he never did come back, which in itself is sort of strange as well. And then what Copeland did was to try and get them deciphered by his friend Kermit Roosevelt. And also, he sent the photographs of the negatives onto the CIA, which, again, we're not really sure why, you know, that would be the case, because presumably these were just old scrolls, you know, of a religious nature. Now, the CIA has actually never officially said, well, you know, we still hold this scroll and, you know, we're not going to give it back. They actually just won't talk about it, which in itself, you know, is kind of intriguing. But Copeland said, you know, he saw and handled this scroll. It was sent to CIA headquarters. And he said he heard sort of whispers and rumors back that it supposedly related to the Book of Daniel and was filled with tales and stories of prophecies and strange dreams and, you know, sort of prophetic dreams. Now, what's interesting is that we know from the 50s onwards, at least, the CIA was very interested in things like prophecies and psychic powers, because, you know, they later utilized all this in their so-called remote viewing program, sort of psychic spying on the Russians. So it would make sense, one of the things I point out in the book, it would kind of make sense if the CIA in the early late 40s and early 50s was trying to understand the nature of psychic powers and prophecies and looking at the espionage angle of things like ESP. It would have been to their advantage to actually consult some of these ancient texts that talked about that sort of thing, and I suspect that's why they were keen to get their hands on this one and also keep it. So that's sort of the first inkling we get, if you like, of sort of U.S. government involvement in digging into the mysteries of the past.
Thank you for that very intriguing information. And, of course, too, the American cryptologist would be of top rate caliber. Mm-hmm. Another example, and boy, this floored me, Nick, you mentioned a very intriguing transcription project that allegedly involved the finding of a proto-biblical text in an alien crash. Mm. I guess one account was that it occurred at White Sands Proving Ground, New Mexico in 1947. There's also an alternate counter-location proposed at Aztec the following year. Boy, that was interesting.
Yeah, this is sort of like a carry-on trace from that from the previous story. The story from Miles Copeland, you know, about the CIA getting its hands on that particular skull, you know, other people have come forward, so there's no doubt about that at all. You know, that's a verifiable part of the CIA's involvement. But the story has sort of another angle to it as well, and it comes from two researchers, one named Bill Steinman. Back in the mid-1980s, Bill Steinman co-wrote a book called UFO Crash at Aztec, Aztec being a place in northern Mexico, where there were claims of a crashed UFO incident in March 1948. The other story came from a man named Timothy Cooper, whose father worked at Holloman Air Force Base, New Mexico, in the 40s, and his father told him this story. His name is Harry B. Cooper, and Cooper Sr. told Cooper Jr. this story about how when he was at Holloman, and it was basically one of his assignments was, you know, to sort of copy, laboriously copy as it was back then with the technology, documents and files, you know, that needed to be duplicated for other people and on base. And one of these files apparently dealt with the crash of a UFO somewhere on the White Sands Proving Ground, or as it is today, the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. And supposedly, in the wreckage of the saucers found in both Aztec and at White Sands, that when the military reportedly managed to sort of access the wrecked vehicles, whatever they were, in Egypt found these very ancient-looking scrolls that, with hindsight, looked and sounded very much like the Dead Sea Scrolls. You know, they were sort of rolled-up parchments, etc., of very similar nature. And reportedly, they were handed over to code-breaking experts from people like, from agencies like the National Security Agency, and, you know, looked at by some of the world's experts in ancient languages. And apparently there was some, or a lot of trouble in deciphering them, because they seem to be written, some of the language could be understood and was sort of very ancient Middle Eastern writing and text, but some of it seemed to predate even those languages, and, you know, they had a harder time deciphering it. But, you know, the interesting thing is that this sort of dovetails, but in a different way, with the story coming out of the Middle East with Miles Copeland. You know, it talks about official interest in ancient scrolls. So, you know, in that respect, we have sort of two angles of what sounds like one story, and at the end of it, you know, what it demonstrates is, in 47, sort of profound government interest in ancient scrolls for reasons which, you know, we've got a few snippets and ideas, but, you know, the overwhelming secrecy that kind of surrounds it suggests that there's probably still a great deal more to be uncovered on all this, I think.
Boy, that's fascinating information. And, you know, Nick, I too was floored by the fact that your book notes that Cooper, the researcher, was told that in order to decipher the proto-biblical text, the top U.S. code breakers, the cryptographers, linguists at the NSA at Fort Meade, Maryland, by 1955, were studying this document, and that the nature of this proto-text was confirmed. Boy, to me, that's very, very impressive. Now, Nick, I want to go to two room questions. We have brilliant researchers who often visit the room. They're great admirers of your work. Now, I plan to discuss with you much later in this interview, or perhaps in the midpoint, your great research involving new construction concepts, the work of Morris, but also your studies of the important effects and some of the projects that have involved Stonehenge, the Henge, and Avebury. We have one of our great researchers, Mark. If you note in the room, please, is your site Unusual Historic Places? But anyway, this is his question for you, Nick. He wants to know, Nick, if you've heard anything about humanoids that live in the caves in Southwest America. And on a second topic, are the UFOs hovering over Avebury, Stonehenge, and the Royal White Stones? Well, are there still UFOs over there? I know your book mentions interesting plasma activity around there, at least in the recent past.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually aware of a number of UFO encounters in and around the Avebury area. A lot of them aren't always, you know, sort of large metallic-looking UFOs. They're more like small balls of light. And actually quite, I mean, one thing to be aware of, both Stonehenge and Avebury are in the county of Wiltshire, very ancient county, and that's also where every year the crop circles turn up. And crop circles are associated with these strange balls of light that fly over the formations. And many of the reports of UFO activity at Avebury actually involve reports that sound just like these balls of light seen in the nearby crop circles. You know, Avebury is actually the sort of prime crop circle territory. So, you know, we are talking about UFOs in the literal sense, but we're not talking about sort of huge structured UFOs over Avebury, but we are talking about what seem to be intelligently controlled somehow balls of light that zip in and around the stones. I've got a number of reports like that, and a lot of reports like that from Stonehenge. And as far as sort of, you know, definitive UFO activity, there was actually a very famous report over Stonehenge in 1994 when, like, one of these huge black triangles was seen literally adjacent to the Stonehenge formation late at night, only about sort of 70 or 80 feet off the ground. So in other words, you know, these things, whatever they are, definitely are attracted to, you know, areas that ancient man perceived as being magical, and I guess paid homage to them by, you know, building these incredible structures.
Thank you very much for that very thoughtful response. Nick, also we have an additional question coming in from a visitor to the room. And he or she wants to know if there's any information about the Hollow Earth and Admiral Byrd. Now, I know Hollow Earth is definitely a very much is a controversial concept.
Yeah.
Admiral Byrd and what he found, that's controversial, but there seem to be quite a few reports on that.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't got anything sort of new on Admiral Byrd, but I just realized that this sort of, I guess, ties in with the second part of the previous question, which I forgot to ask her about caves in the southwest, etc. What I would say is throughout culture and history and folklore and mythology of pretty much every nation on the planet, you know, there are stories of sort of supernatural and magical entities that live deep underground, almost lived alongside us, but in stealth, if you like. You know, they lived in ancient caverns and caves, and that, you know, they're almost as if they were like a coexisting ancient offshoot of the human race, you know, in the same way that today we're Homo sapien. Before us, you know, the Cro-Magnon man and Neanderthal man, et cetera, et cetera. The idea is that perhaps there are even more offshoots, you know, and that perhaps some of them went underground and occasionally surface, and that, you know, they provoke our stories of, you know, magical beings like demons or, you know, pixies or goblins, you know, living underground, but they may actually be, you know, a sort of an indigenous ancient race. And I'm not actually aware, to just go back to the previous question, of any reports specifically from the southwest, but I am aware of a report from the northwest that a man, he passed away a couple of years ago, named Matt Tibb, wrote a book called The Crypto-Terrestrial. It was actually about this very subject of sort of ancient races living deep underground. Mac actually uncovered a story of some sort of like diminutive human-looking entities that sort of lived underground and in caves somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. So, you know, maybe that's sort of tied in with some of these stories. But on the other question, I honestly never sort of really dug into the Admiral Byrd thing. You know, I know the basics, but I haven't sort of looked at it to where I can say, you know, I can add anything new to it, really. So.
Thank you again. Very thoughtful and informative responses. And, you know, Nick, too, I had heard you in a recent interview just briefly mention Mount Shasta. And here I'd like to make a comment. I don't know this couple's name, but they're charming. Mm-hmm. They're at all the conferences. The husband always has a cane. And I know the lovely lady has told me very directly that she's convinced that there are inhabitants underground in the Mount Shasta area, that I should look into this. So I'm keeping an ear out, you know, if anyone wants to just write in and they'd like to speak.
I mean, Mount Shasta's a very interesting place. You know, there are legends supposedly that the survivors from Atlantis and Lemuria, they supposedly made their way to Mount Shasta and, you know, reportedly lived deep inside in sort of hollow caverns. There's UFO reports from Mount Shasta. There was a very famous Bigfoot report there in 1976 that reported by a number of people from a logging company that were working in the area and saw this particular creature. There's even a story about the legendary, for people who've heard of him, Count Saint Germain. This sort of ancient character who supposedly achieved immortality centuries ago and takes on sort of different guises throughout, you know, his life. One of the legends is that he dwelled there for some time. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting legends and stories going right back to Native American times all about, you know, mystical activity on Mount Shasta.
Boy, thanks for that very intriguing information. It's very helpful. And, you know, Nick, too, that would explain for me the reason per UFO Undercover this Wednesday with our great host Joe Montaldo and our Virginia ICAR director, Karis Molina Brown, why she's holding a meeting and some courses in the Mount Shasta area. I believe information on that would be at, I think it's KarisMolinaBrown.com. Sound very, very interesting courses. Now, Nick, back to your book. You have some very thoughtful and detailed discussion on the topic of Noah's Ark and the search by various governments for information and possible retrieval of that ancient object.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of as weird as the Dead Sea Scrolls angle, really, Trace. The reason being that, you know, again, like with the Dead Sea Scrolls, you would imagine that Noah's Ark would not be a subject of interest for military or intelligence agencies. You know, they should be involved in, you know, addressing the capabilities of overseas, you know, missile systems or that sort of thing, you know, spying on the enemy, that kind of angle. You wouldn't imagine their role would be to analyze evidence or stories relating to an ancient ark. Unless, you know, as I point out in the book, maybe there's more to the ark than it just being some sort of ancient boat. The story, you know, the biblical story of Noah's Ark is that, you know, there was this huge flood and God supposedly told Noah to build this huge ark and populate it with two-by-two animals, etc., etc. And it reportedly came to rest high on the slopes of Mount Ararat in Turkey. Now, you can go throughout history and, you know, the entirety of, civilization and culture and find that all cultures pretty much around the world have flood legends attached to them. You know, it's not just the Bible account. There are actually dozens. Native American Indians, Australian Aborigines, Scandinavia, Ireland, Middle East, all India, all around the world, you know, there are these stories of flood legends. And they all have the same sort of underlying theme that God or the gods specifically picked out certain people to build these sort of mighty arcs in which to survive along with animals and, you know, a significant number of people. For example, one of the other legends is the story of Gilgamesh. This involves a man, his name was Utnapishtim, and he basically built this huge boat sort of according, you know, to his own deities, etc. But instead of, landing on Mount Ararat, that ark actually comes down in India, you know. So we have a lot of stories like this. But, you know, I think collectively what this is, that there probably was in ancient times, you know, a huge cataclysmic flood. And some of these flood legends got distorted and, you know, mythology was attached to them to where different areas seem to have very similar stories. Now, that aside, most intriguing of all is why and how various governments have sort of looked into this. And as far, you know, we don't know to what extent anybody has done the most research, but we know the most data that we have on comes from the U.S. government. And as far as the U.S. government's interest in Noah's Ark is concerned, this goes back to 1949, when a U.S. Air Force bomber, which was on a spying mission to the borders of the former Soviet Union, they had permission to fly over Turkey, with, you know, Turkey being our friends. And this was basically a mission to photograph and film from a high altitude as possible this new military base that the Russians are building very near the border of Turkey, of strategic importance.
Yes.
And they were using Mount Ararat as sort of like a guiding pointer to get towards this base. As they flew near the top of Mount Ararat, which, you know, because it's so high up, it's literally like 17,000 feet, you know, it's permanently pretty much snow-capped and ice-capped all year round. One of the people on board the plane, one of the personnel, said he could see this, what looked like a huge wing-like structure about 600 feet long, partly sticking out the thick snow and ice, and, you know, but he could make out the outline even though part of it was buried. And so the pilot got permission to swing the plane around to photograph whatever this thing was. As they were turning, one of the other guys on the plane said he could see a similar structure a little distance away from the first one, but of about roughly equal length, again about 600 feet. So if these were wings, they had like an overall width of 1,200 feet, you know, which is just impossible for one of our aircraft. You know, nobody was building anything like that back then, or even today, you know, a 1,200-foot-wide wingspan aircraft. You know, it's just unbelievable. So they took these photographs and then carried on with the original mission, came back to base and said, you know, along the lines of, you're not going to believe what we filmed. And the photographs literally kind of vanished into the heart of the mountain. And one observer has actually surfaced in recent years, but not a reproduced book. But not many of them, you know, most of them still languish wherever things like this languish, you know. So, but this basically kick-started the U.S. government's interest in trying to determine what Noah's Ark was or is. And from the Air Force's files and photographs, etc., the CIA got interested in the early 50s, the National Reconnaissance Office, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and a number of military people have come forward as, you know, sort of photographic experts who've said, you know, when I was in the military, I was asked to analyze this photograph that showed something weird on Mount Ararat. Now, of course, you know, if it, as I said, if it was just a wooden old boat, why the interest? But one of the things we do know is that some of the departments and projects that were looking at the Noah's Ark story were actually also involved in collating information on UFOs. And this has sort of led to the inevitable theory that, you know, could Noah's Ark not have been sort of like an old, relatively straightforward and rudimentary wooden boat filled with animals? What if it was a space ark built by extraterrestrials who saw this cataclysmic flood looming? And so it was they who sort of sought out a number of people to save, and possibly instead of having the animals on board two by two, what if they had sort of massive databanks of animal DNA, which could be used to, you know, kickstart the planet again after the floodwaters receded. And what makes that theory interesting is that although the biblical account talks about, you know, Noah taking two by two animals on board, Gilgamesh and a number of other stories talk about the essence of the animals or the seed of life of the animals being taken on board. You know, and the essence and the seed of life does sound more like a massive DNA collection. You know, and that's the sort of thing we do today. You know, a woman who has problems getting pregnant, you know, they preserve her eggs until time, you know, when she may be able to. You know, it's maybe not that different. So that's one of the theories, is that the trust on the part of the government in Noah's Ark relates to this theory, that it could be like, almost like an ancient Roswell, you know, an ancient UFO smashes into the side of the mountain, slides down part of the way, and then gets caught up in all the ice and snow, and has kind of been buried there for thousands of years. You know, that's the sort of intriguing theory related to all this. Now, of course, the big problem is that the Turkish government doesn't want everybody and his brother kind of clambering around the top of their mountain. So I think that's why, when we look at the files, you know, they're talking a great deal about photographs and spy satellite footage, etc., but not sort of a quick reaction retrieval team, you know, hauling the thing down the mountain, because no one can get permission to do that. And probably it would be an incredible, you know, sort of task in, you know, just the mechanics of actually achieving that, you know, bringing some 1,200 foot wide object or long object down the side of a huge mountain. You know, it might not even be feasible.
Boy, that's intriguing information. And, you know, Nick, in your book, you do reference the American military personnel who either saw the Ark or were trying to decipher photographic elements. You mentioned the testimony, for example, of a Captain Gregor Schwinghammer, who, while stationed with the U.S. Air Force at Adana, I believe it's pronounced Adana, Turkey? Adana, Turkey. Anyway, I hope I pronounced it correctly, saw what he believed resembled a huge rectangular barge. Yeah. Also, he believed that a U-2 had been utilized on more than one occasion to view the Ark. And there's also a really interesting quote you give, and that is, you reference the account of a U.S. military serviceman, Bill Todd, who viewed the object on Mount Ararat, and it's described in your book that gentleman's words as, quote, a large rectangular-shaped slate-colored ship, end quote. That does sound rather advanced technology. You know, it's intriguing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the important thing, that these people are speaking on the record, you know, years later about what they've seen, and they're all talking about it from their own perspective of, you know, the piece of work they did or what this person did. And the important, that, to me, that's always important, because if everybody was sort of parrot fashioning, you know, the same exact thing, then you would think, well, it may have been a cover story, and everybody was told to say exactly this, but you know, everybody's telling it from what they remember from their perspective. They had their own unique input or saw something or looked at a photograph. But when you collectively put it together, what we see is massive interest at an official level in trying to determine what this thing on Mount Ararat was and still is. Now, to give you an extent of the sort of the sheer extent that the CIA went to in terms of following up on every lead, you know, just like what I'm doing now, you know, promoting the book on your show, back in 1975, really coincidentally, there was actually two or three books all published that year about Noah's Ark. And, of course, you know, like with your show now, you know, the authors promoting their books. One of them, a man named Fernando Navarra, he had a book out which he was actually publicizing at a shopping mall called the Iverson Mall in Washington, D.C. And a number of the now declassified through the Freedom of Information Act files from the CIA talks about how CIA operatives from the National Photographic Interpretation Center sort of went out in plain clothes and listened to what he had to say, you know, when he was giving his little lecture at the shopping mall, and they actually sort of engaged him in conversation about his thoughts on Noah's Ark and, you know, what his book was saying, etc. So, in other words, this kind of makes a mockery of the idea that the government isn't interested. But what it also shows is agents are actually being sent out to sort of sit in the audiences at lectures on Noah's Ark, and they're from the CIA. That demonstrates far more than just, you know, passing or cursory interest. This demonstrates, you know, sort of a massive, all-encompassing collection point for just about everything on Noah's Ark, you know, that could conceivably possibly be obtained.
That the data was really of extreme interest. And to our wonderful network owner, I'm hearing some pinging. It could be bad storms in the area because we want to catch all of Nick's commentary on this. And thank you again to our wonderful network owner. Now, you know, Nick, on the Noah's Ark issue, your book references the interest of astronaut James Irwin as well as Senator Barry Goldwater, a favorite American political figure from Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, James Irwin, you know, one of the more famous, I say more famous, they were all famous, but he's one of the Apollo astronauts. And he actually developed a deep interest in Noah's Ark and actually spent time going out to Mount Ararat, Turkey. He took part in a number of expeditions. He only came to a halt when he had a bad fall and he had to sort of basically, you know, sort of give up on his on-site investigations. But we're not sure how. But way back in the, at least the early 1980s, James Irwin actually started to hear these rumors about the CIA having some role in the Noah's Ark story. And he actually telephoned out of the blue at home, one particular CIA man who he'd heard was somehow involved in all this and sort of put him on the spot and say, you know, did you find Noah's Ark? And he said, no, he never found Noah's Ark. But years later, he did admit that, well, you know, there were photographs that seemed to show something. But, you know, the CIA have actually called whatever this thing is Noah's Ark. Officially, within the Pentagon and the CIA, it's known as the Ararat Anomaly, the term it. But James Irwin had heard these stories, you know, at least as far back as about 1982, that, you know, the CIA was looking for something and possibly hiding something. Now, Goldwater, he too heard these stories, and they came from, you know, some of his constituents and people like that. And so he approached, you know, the Air Force and the CIA and, you know, basically said, can you help this person, you know, with this inquiry? And I'll understand, you know, if there are any security matters to it, and, you know, then I won't push it any further. And even Goldwater, as someone who was a former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he's also the Republican Party's nominee for president in the 1964 election. You know, even he couldn't get to the bottom of it and basically walked away from it all, believing that there was some sort of national security issue surrounding the story of Noah's Ark.
Boy, that's very intriguing as well. Thank you for that information. And, you know, the extent of interest in this Noah's existence, and also the photographic images, and indeed that one in your book is truly remarkable. It definitely would seem very, very credible to me, a very strong photographic image. You know, though, connections there, of course, with, now this is very interesting, well, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, but also with Project Moondust. I found that very intriguing.
Yeah, Project Moondust is a verifiable, legitimate U.S. military program that began in the 1950s, and the best way is it was basically secure for the U.S. military overseas technologies. That's to say, you know, it still exists today, but it has a new name, but that name is still classified. Nobody has successfully found out what that name is, and, you know, I don't know what it is either, but it used to be called Project Moondust up until the 80s. And basically the scenario is, you know, let's say a Chinese spy satellite, you know, plummets to Earth and it crashes in the Nevada desert. Project Moondust would be the guys like the Quick Reaction Retrieval Team who would go out and recover it, and they would take it to the Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. And the FTD guys, it was their job, you know, to say, well, you know, this is interesting technology, but it's not as advanced as ours. Or, you know, it's very interesting because it's way in front of us and we didn't realize they'd got anything this sophisticated because it beats us. So the idea was if it was behind us, there'd be a sigh of relief. If it was ahead of us, then they would analyze it and try and find a way to catch up. So it's basically acquiring overseas, you know, advanced military weapon systems, etc. And it's interesting that Project Moondust were copied on a lot of the files on Noah's Ark. You know, this very agency who deal with sort of foreign technologies. Now, of course, over the years, Project Moondust, there have been a lot of rumors suggesting that they're the actual sort of the crash retrieval people who go out to recover crashed UFOs, which would make sense because, you know, there's not much difference between a foreign technology and an alien technology, you know, and it probably would be analyzed by the same people. And, you know, the very fact that Project Moondust would be involved in the Noah's Ark story, this kind of suggests that the Ark possessed some sort of technology to it. You know, how anyone can analyze a piece of wood and say it's a piece of wood. You know, not to be flippant, but that you can. So I think this by default, you know, Moondust involvement alone suggests that there had to be, either there was an advanced technology involved or they deeply suspected there was some technology up there that they wanted to get their hands on. And I talk about this in the book in relation to how supposedly got files and photographs. And the guy who told me the story, there are inklings, because it came from his father, there are inklings that there may have been some sort of covert drop of military personnel onto the mountain at some point, like a stealthy private drop of people to try and access whatever this was. And there was talk of them coming across at least part of it, which was like a huge metallic shell. You know, nothing inside it, no fantastic machinery, as if it had just been, you know, sort of plundered, who knows, hundreds of years before, thousands, you know, we don't know. But it was just kind of described as like a rusted old shell, and it was just that huge that, you know, it would just be a huge task to even, of engineering, to even try and move it, you know. But the fact that it was, again, tied with Moondust suggests, you know, there's another aspect to this story that still remains to be sort of fully researched, I think.
That's a very interesting explanation. Thank you, Nick. And, you know, when you think about it, the fact that Noah's Ark has such a pivotal role in so many of the world's cultures, details on this, accurate details, would truly be of interest to our culture and history.
Well, it would, but I think one of the reasons why there's been a lot of controversy is this sort of fear or worry that would it rewrite religion? You know, there are a lot of people, you know, I'm not saying it would or it wouldn't, because we can never really know until we know what's up there. But, you know, if it was proved to be, on the one hand, if it was proved to be a huge wooden ark, then that would uphold the old stories. If it was proved to be an alien spacecraft, that would massively rewrite the old stories and probably cause untold uproar. And I suspect that part of the secrecy relative to all this revolves around not wanting to upset, you know, the sort of status quo of planetary and, you know, personal belief systems and that sort of thing. I think that's why there's so much of this material evidence is hidden and kept away from us.
Very intriguing response. And, you know, Nick, as well, one of your several books includes the subject of NASA, some of the fascinating photographic image it has received. We have one of our researchers here in the field, very bright person, Julsa, and she's wondering if you do you have any information, what would you know about Tycho Crater on the Moon?
Not that much, to be honest. I mean, I actually have written about the moon in one of my previous books, Keep Out, from the perspective of, you know, astronomers, you know, going back centuries, seeing strange flashing lights on the surface of the moon. And, you know, even in some of the NASA photographs, you know, there are images that seem to show formations of rocks or things on the moon that don't look natural. You know, they look too linear. And some of these do come from craters. You know, the idea that's been sort of postulated that perhaps some of these deep craters might actually be you know, entrance points to sort of underground installations and things like that. You know, one of the things I talk about is how a group in government in the late 70s actually remote viewed the moon and apparently came across evidence that there were sort of vast underground installations under some of the craters. I'm not sure if that was one of them or not. I truthfully can't remember now, but, you know, there are a lot of stories like that, at least, of sort of weird activity on the surface of the moon.
Intriguing information there. And, you know, Nick, on this theme of repopulation of the Earth after a catastrophic event such as the Great Flood, you note that government authorities were very interested in the accounts of George Van Tassel. I believe you rendered his account. It was very powerful in your book on contactees.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned,
that's right, yeah.
And in your latest book, you mentioned that at an important Denver conference, which was previously mentioned on this interview show by a wonderful journalist like yourself, I don't believe you gave the name, though, you do identify George Van Tassel mm-hmm. as speaking at this, it was at the invitation of the Denver Unidentified Flying Objects Investigative Society at Denver's mm-hmm. Phipps Auditorium. And apparently, during this speech, George Van Tassel mentioned the topics of E.T., seeding of the Earth with its creatures, and then the development of the human race after catastrophic polar tilts, and the FBI particularly being interested in the religious and economic implications of an E.T. presence or past presence.
Yeah, that's right, Tracy. Basically, George Van Bolden's in UFOs goes back to the early 50s. He was living out at a place called Giant Rock, just outside a town called Landers in California. And it's named Giant Rock because there's this huge rock in the desert where he had his contactee type encounters. And he put on a yearly conference there every year and, you know, invite all the sort of 1950s famous ufologist out to speak, and he literally attracted audiences in like 12,000, you know, which is unheard of at today's conferences, but that was the size of the audience he used to get. But, you know, he was on the UFO scene for years, and the FBI built up a substantial file on Van Tassel, which actually runs to about 400 pages and spans about 14 years. But they were particularly interested and prepared a lengthy report on this lecture he gave at the Phipps Auditorium in Denver, Colorado. And you're quite right that the FBI were actually particularly interested by the fact that, you know, although it was UFO themed, it was heavily based around religion, economics, etc. And, you know, I think that was one of the issues that sort of concerned them, is that, you know, he was preaching to a large audience and, you know, talking about very alternative ways of living to sort of, you know, the regular US way, I guess, I suppose, at the time. But, Van Tassel, you know, easily, you know, there were alien visitations in the distance, and that there'd been a number of cataclysmic events which had sort of, you know, reduced the primitive human population levels, you know, when we're perhaps, you know, very primitive type animals, to, you know, very low levels, and, you know, it resulted in the extermination of the dinosaurs and a lot of other animals, you know, just became extinct as well, like the mammoth and the saber-toothed tiger. And so, you know, on every occasion, it wasn't like the planet was wiped out, but, you know, you had surviving pockets all over the place, but there was no sort of, you know, unified civilization. It was just everywhere was in disarray. So the story that Van Tassel was supposedly told by his alien contacts was that, you know, these entities had come back periodically when there was a massive disaster on the planet, and they'd foreseen it coming. And so, you know, they prepared and, you know, with these seeds of life, etc., these gigantic space arcs to achieve some sort of stability back on the planet by reseeding it and, you know, teaching the people how to live and, you know, giving them rules and regulations, kind of like the Ten Commandments. And he actually was told and related at the conference, which the FBI covered quite extensively, he was told that Adam and Eve, rather than being, as the Bible says, like a man and a woman, he was told that they were actually the names of races, you know, that were involved in this sort of reseeding and populating of the planet again, you know, and but the term Adam and Eve sort of was then became, you know, linked in with just one person, you know, a man and a woman. And the FBI took a great deal of interest in this because he also spoke about, you know, the legend of Noah's Ark, supposedly being one of these huge space arcs that was responsible for, you know, bringing animals back to the planet and people and, you know, kick-starting some degree of civilization again. And as I said, they followed his work for years and, you know, sort of scrupulously recorded pretty much everything he was saying and doing.
So they must have considered his information to be rather of a serious nature, one that very much merited attention. Now, Nick, we're about to take a 10-minute break and then return to the second segment of the interview. I've already learned so much. Thank you. Can't wait to resume the interview in 10 minutes' time. And in the interim, just to mention to our audience, two great websites there, nickredfern.com and nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com. We'll be right back in 10. Thank you.
Thank you. Breaking news. Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated and scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God. My God. They're beaming me up with them. Don't put that probe there. Don't put that probe there. Don't put a... There. Ooh. 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 Listen to the Judge of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchett, bringing you The High Strange. Visit www.judgeofmabusradio.com. That's www.judgeofmabusradio.com.
Hey! Hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Tune into the Mind Cemetery with us, Chip and Nicole, every Monday night.
From 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, as we delve into UFOs, abduction, ghosts, aliens, conspiracy, cryptozoology.
And don't forget those creepy topics you won't hear in your local news.
That's the Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Facebook.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. For the Rob Simone Talk Show, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hello everyone, Trish Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Come join us each Friday evening at A Global Focus's new time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Come join the discussion.
Are you a fan of the unknown?
Do you constantly watch the skies, wondering if there's something out there?
In fear of things going bump in the night?
This Trish Radio brings you head first into the world of the paranormal with the latest news and interviews with the paranormal elite.
With hosts Jordan Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed in the world of ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Richard's Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514-1600.
Visit us at www.whispersradio.com.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. This is Second Sight NYC. You can join us each Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
We're a parapsychic radio show that isn't afraid to push the limits.
We have limits?
Well, if we do, we haven't found them yet.
Chris is the godfather of psychic mediums, and he'll give you a reading you can't refuse.
You better believe it. And Stephanie is the co-hostess with the mostest.
Relax there, Chris.
Yeah, okay. Second Sight NYC is the show that even the spirits listen to.
How can you make such a claim?
Well, the spirits told me. Give us 2 hours to open your minds to the possibilities of what could be.
This show is all about what is seen and unseen, known and unknown, and everything in between.
Each week, we make the unbelievable believable.
Join us.
Are you a fan of the unknown.
Do you constantly watch the sky, wondering
out there, fear of things going bump in the
night? Whispers Radio brings you headfirst into the world of the paranormal with the latest news and interviews with the paranormal elite.
With hosts Jordan Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed in the world of ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Whispers Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514-1600.
Visit us at www.whispersradio.com.
Light up your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm psychic medium Christopher George, and I have a new show that will air the first Friday of every month from 11 to midnight Eastern Standard Time. The show is called Insight with psychic medium Christopher George. It's all about psychic readings. I welcome my listeners to call in for a free reading. Just remember, don't ask me a question that you really don't want the answer to. I'll give it to you the way the spirits give it to me. Straightforward and real. The first Friday of every month, Insight, 11 to midnight.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current news and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can always catch it here, Flipside, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to A Global Focus with guest Nick Redfern, full-time author and journalist, and specialist in unsolved mysteries. We are discussing Nick Redfern's latest book, The Pyramids and the Pentagon, the government's top secret pursuit of mystical relics, ancient astronauts, and lost civilizations. Two of Nick's websites, nickredfern.com and nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com. Welcome back, everyone, to A Global Focus with this guest, Nick Redfern, our featured guest this week. Great discussion. Nick's excellent research and books can be accessed at his website, www.nickredfern.com and nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com. And very briefly, at this point of the show, I just always mention to our listeners to not miss the excellent programs on our network. These include UFO Undercover, Wednesday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern with host Joe Montaldo, Second Sight, New York City on Thursday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern with co-hosts Stephanie Benetti and psychic medium Chris George, on Friday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern, Through the Keyhole with host Karen Dolan, directly before this program. Also, a very popular new program on the internet is News on the Flip Side, right here on UPRN, Saturdays from 11 p.m. Eastern, with co-host Stephanie Benetti and Joe Montaldo. And that is followed by Jeff Pritchett and Church of Mavis. Other popular programs include Mind Cemetery on Monday evenings with Chip and Nicole. Don't miss this past Monday's interview with Bryce Zabel on Mind Cemetery, and of course that's available at our UPRN network archives. Nick, thank you so much for this great interview. Yeah. I can't wait to start the second segment. And I'm sorry, I just want to make one comment here. Boy, I am showing my age here. I had forgotten to note the website of a very close colleague of ICAR, and that is the historian and teacher, Mark, with his website at marksancientsites.com. And that site also includes some excellent photos. He was mentioning how much he appreciates your research as well. Nick, very much so. And again, Mark's site is marksancientsites.com. Now, Nick, this interview, of course, Your book, as your other books, discusses a wide spectrum of research. Now, for example, you give detailed summaries and analysis of past and present historians and researchers' interest in how the ancient monuments, such as the pyramids and Stonehenge, were constructed. You mentioned even some of the cultural material, the reference to non-conventional methods for building these massive monuments. For example, you note even back around 896 A.D., the date of birth of Abu Hassan Ali al-Masudi, born in Baghdad, that his lengthy series of volumes includes reference to the fact that the pyramids might have been constructed with non-conventional technologies. And you note the research of contemporary Americans, Richard E. Mooney, for example. Mr. Mooney noting that the priests in the construction, that per the historical records and cultural records, the priests in the construction of the American monuments had this reference to making the stones light and a possible connection to levitation of the stones.
Yeah, this is basically something, Trace, that runs through all cultural world that have evidence or exhibit evidence of, you know, having built massive stone structures, whether it's the, you know, the pyramids in Egypt, whether it's vast ancient Roman and Greek structures, the similar pyramids in Central and South America, Stonehenge in Britain, etc. They all have these stories attached to them, that rather than having been built by, shall we say, you know, rollers and ropes and pulleys and just brute force, that there was another technology involved, possibly one that today we've, you know, forgotten about, lost, and just relegated to the realms of mythology, you know, and folklore, that, oh, it's just, you know, it's just stories, you just cannot be, you know, because we can't envisage the idea of moving stones in any other way. But it seems that the ancients may have possessed a technology that in many ways is so far advanced today, but it seems so mysterious that, you know, it didn't seem to involve, you know, huge power systems like factories and things like this, where we would perhaps see surviving remnants today. It was almost like it was like a spiritual or psychic energy, maybe, that they used, or something along those lines. But if you look at all these stories and rumors around the world, what I'm going to say now sounds a little bit strange at first until I explain it, but they all talk about the stones either being raised and maneuvered into place by what was described as like magical music, or to the sound of supernatural tunes, or to magical musical instruments. Now, basically, what they're talking about is using sound to raise these vast stones. And that might sound strange, but today's military is actually actively researching this. It's basically called acoustic levitation. And the best way to describe it, it's where you have two sound frequencies which oppose each other and create what are called interference sound waves. And in between these sort of interference sound waves, you've got what's called a resonance zone. And if you apply and direct these sound waves, you can actually raise objects within these resonant zones. It's the best way to describe it. The military's had some success actually at raising small objects, but the idea is that the ancients may have used this technology to raise literally massive stones, you know, multi-ton stones, and because they were using sound, that probably, in my view at least, provoked these legends, you know, that it was magical music and, you know, to the tunes of magical instruments and that sort of thing. You know, they were distorted, passed down, perhaps three or four generations that got distorted, but still had at the heart of them these stories about sound being used. Now, you know, you talked about this guy, Abu al-Hassan Ali al-Masudi, which is a little bit of a mouthful to say as well. And, yeah, he told basically this story. He's a very well-traveled and learned person and, you know, kind of went on road trips, you know, as we would call them today, and just traveled around the Middle East and India and different places, recording everything that, you know, he came across. And one of the things that he did stumble upon was this particular story about how he was told that the Egyptian pyramids were sort of secretly built, and it was a technology that apparently actually not the pharaohs, he had stories that maybe there was an even ancient, more ancient culture that there are many of these structures in Egypt, and that perhaps the ancient Egyptians inherited them rather than built them. Now, whoever the original constructors were, they supposed to have this technology where they would have these rows and rows of these metal rods all standing in line, and the keeper of the stones, if you like, would strike the stones with one of these rods, and they would sort of raise into the air only like 3 or 4 feet and kind of rock like a boat on water, you know, but they would be weighing multi-tons, and they would sort of slowly push and prod them between these iron rods to where they were needed, and then they would be touched and pushed again, you know, and raised higher. And it was sort of a laborious, bit of a slow process, but, you know, it was far quicker than using pulleys and ropes, which would be pretty much impossible anyway. And he tells this story, and it actually sounds, you know, like some sort of advanced metallic-based technology being used to move these stones in some fashion. But other ones are sort of more clear, where they talk about sound itself being directly, you know, pointed at these different structures, and the stones just literally sort of sailing through the air like a kite almost, you know, or a balloon that's escaped from its tether, except, you know, that they were directing them and guiding them into place. Now, you know, the fact of the matter is today, we would have a very hard time building some of these structures using the techniques that historians and archaeologists assure us ancient man did use. You know, it's like Stonehenge. A lot of people are surprised how small Stonehenge is. You know, it's not a huge formation. But, you know, to have been built, you know, 3,000-4,000 years ago, and to have these stones, you know, the upright stones are 18 feet high, and then you have this huge stone, you know, placed on top of two of them. You know, even that defies logic as to how it was actually done, you know, in terms of getting these the top stone that high up, you know, just using rudimentary technologies. And with Stonehenge, the story is, or one of the folklores is that the legendary magician Merlin, who supposedly worked under King Arthur, the story is that he levitated and moved the stones to magical tunes. So again, you know, we have this same story that's been told in South America, in the Middle East, in ancient Roman Greece, and also in Britain, and they all have the same core theme. And also, you know, the story of the walls of Jericho, this is like the same thing in reverse, you know, that the walls were supposedly knocked down to the sound of a trumpet, or trumpets. That might be that same technology used in an offensive way, not rather building way, but to turn that acoustic energy into a weapon. You know, it could be, you know, two-point, if you like.
Boy, thank you for that fascinating information. And your book contains really a full spectrum of discussion on this acoustic levitation and sound acoustic concepts. You referenced Andrew Collins' work as well on the Egyptian Great Pyramid, where he notes, quote, precision geometry incorporating harmonics, proportions, and sound acoustics was incorporated into his exterior and interior design, end quote. And I have a question here from one of our researchers, Raven, from the Northeast. And Raven is wondering, Nick, would you consider that the pyramids were really built as being healing centers for people in the context of sonic healing or harmonic resonance, or perhaps one of their aspects?
That's actually a very good question. I'll tell you for why. Because there was a legend attached to the stones of Stonehenge that they had healing properties that were linked with acoustics. And, you know, we know that the, you know, the pyramids of Egypt and elsewhere, they're basically, you know, just huge resonating sensors. You know, the ancients seem to know something deeply important about acoustics. And actually, healing techniques about physical and psychological illnesses, sound has actually been proved to, you know, substantially help people, not just from the perspective of relaxing them, but there seems to be something about the sort of the resonating effects of acoustics on certain parts of the body can actually help the healing system. So, you know, in that sense, I think the ancient man knew something about acoustics that, you know, we just think it's, you know, acoustics of sort of cranking out, you know, music, you know, at the speakers, not realizing that there's far more to it than that. You know, the mere fact that these places were built specifically, you know, to allow for the greatest and the most, you know, the best clarity in terms of acoustic echoes and resonance, etc., and that they have these stories about, you know, the stones being able to heal. I think this is all sort of part and parcel of this idea that acoustic technology was being utilized for a whole range of different things, whether health or levitation or both. You know.
Thank you very much for that response. And, you know, another interesting focus there for these developments in construction or key concepts is, Nick, you note the work in your book of a Morris K. Jessup, who had served in the U.S. Army. This gentleman had visited several sites in Central America and South America. And, you know, one thing that I thought was really fascinating was the fact you referenced that Jessup indicated in 1955, per his research, that the stonework he had viewed in South America exhibited technique, construction technique, superior to our current civilization, and that he believed the stonework had been achieved before the formation of the Andean glaciers.
Yeah, I mean, Jessup was a very interesting character, and unfortunately, you know, he's one who, in today's ufological world, is very often just forgotten about, not so much dismissed or derided. You know, unfortunately, you know, people sometimes have short memories, and he's somebody who's been, you know, people say, who, when you mention Morris Jessup, but he wrote a very sort of celebrated book that I would sort of everybody to read. It's called The Case for the UFO. And Jessup was someone who had a deep interest in UFOs, but he also had a profound interest in ancient mysteries as well. And he was also, fortunately, someone who, you know, didn't do his research from the armchair. He actually got out into the field and investigated things. And you quite rightly pointed out, I mean, he traveled to Mexico, to Central America, to South America, checking out many of these sort of vast ancient structures, and he came back convinced that whatever technology was involved, it had to be something along the lines of what today we would call levitation or anti-gravity, something along those lines at least. You know, he noticed the sort of the sheer precision where some of these stones, they weren't even linear, you know, sort of right angled, and yet they just fell into place perfectly, as if the rocks had been melted and then just formed together again, you know, in random shapes. And he came to believe that there was just no way, you know, that some of these stones could be lifted, you know, sort of 150 feet in the air, and they're weighing multi-tons, you know. It was just not feasible. And he presented this theory in The Case for the UFO. And, you know, his book sold, and, you know, he got a lot of interest and feedback, etc. But what was most interesting is that he actually got an invite out to Washington, D.C. by a department of the U.S. Navy that was actually like an advanced weapons project or program. You know, that was their job, was to sort of try and develop and understand new weaponry systems for the Navy. And they actually paid for Jessup to, you know, sort of like a clandestine invite, you know, sort of don't tell your friends and family, invite out to D.C., and they paid for his air flight, his hotel, his food, all his expenses, and basically spent a day interviewing him, which kind of turned into almost like a interrogation, I guess, where they wanted to know, you know, where his information was coming from, because he'd heard rumors about the military, you know, involved in some of these types of projects as well, and wrote about them, you know, so they were interested in knowing who was leaking information to him about classified Navy programs, but equally they wanted to know why he felt, you know, anti-gravity and levitation were the answers, and if he had an understanding of how this technology might work. And, of course, you know, he did have more than a few ideas, and he was happy to sort of share the data, but equally he was a little bit daunted and worried about the fact that, you know, he was looking into UFOs and the pyramids, and now he was sort of being grilled by, you know, a special weapons project at the Navy. And so he was one of these people who was a little bit, you know, prone to emotional excesses, and it got him sort of both a bit depressed and nervy and stressed as well, which, you know, had an effect on him. But for Jessup, it all sort of ended in tragedy, because he had in his car in 1959 in a park in Florida, and it was sort of a classic situation, you know, with like a hose pipe going from the exhaust through the window, and he, you know, died from carbon monoxide poisoning. Now, people have said, well, you know, maybe he was depressed and worried about all this stuff going on, and the fact that, you know, he'd recently got divorced, and, you know, none of that's impossible. You know, things can affect people in different ways. Other people rise up against it, you know, and you know, become stronger when faced with adversity. But on the other hand, only 24 hours before he was found dead, Jessup spoke with a friend of his, a Dr. Manson Valentine, who was also heavily involved in ancient mystery investigations, and said he'd found something deeply significant and new that he wanted to tell Valentine about the very next day. And, of course, that never happened because he was found dead. So, you know, 24 hours or 12 hours before he was found, you know, this doesn't sound like a man who was on the verge of killing himself, you know, and this has led to sort of dark rumors that was he terminated because he was getting too close to uncovering some ancient mystery that the military already knew about and wanted to sort of keep to itself rather than, you know, have it spread far and wide. You know, it's sort of a mysterious gray area, but, you know, we have a very sort of fascinating legacy of Jessup's work, and I recommend anybody to read his book, The Case for the UFO, and also a book written by a woman named Anna Genslinger called The Jessup Dimension, which goes into the very deeply into the issue of whether he was murdered or not for what he found out.
Thanks for that very intriguing information, and it directly pertains to a question by one of our senior researchers, who herself must have read information to the effect that unfortunately Mr. Jessup had met an untimely end, but it sounds as though he had quite the career achievements and that he was quite an innovative and brilliant thinker. Now, you know, Nick, on this aspect of the government seeking information and being aware of perhaps important new developments, what I found very intriguing was the quote in your book. It's from 1974, and the quote you note is that of Donald E. Kehoe, retired Marine Corps major, that the U.S. Air Force promoted anti-gravity research projects with aerospace companies, technical labs, scientists, other researchers, that they encouraged this. The aspect of secret contracts was a factor. And, of course, to me, that relates to that compartmentalization aspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Kehoe, you know, was a guy who was really on the scene big time in the 1950s. You know, he wrote a lot of books, and he carried on writing through the 70s, but, I mean, certainly was pretty much at his peak in terms of, you know, exposing government secrets as it related to UFO activity. But in 1974, he basically sort of went public with what he knew about a number of U.S. military programs in terms of researching gravity, anti-gravity, the sort of exploitation and harnessing of gravity, you know, as a weapon, essentially, or at least, and, you know, a tool of technology. And I forget the actual number of programs that he said were the military were actively researching from this perspective, but it was, you know, it was dozens. It was like 30 or 40 something projects that he was that the military supposedly had sort of subcontracted out to, you know, these contractors that sign secrecy oaths and do work on behalf of the military. And he said, you know, anti-gravity, levitation, these are prime areas that a whole range of agencies and of the military were trying to understand and harness. And, you know, this sort of follows on from, you know, you had Jessup from the late 40s through the 50s. Then we know from in the 60s a man named Bruce Cathy, a New Zealand-based researcher, who was doing very similar research to Jessup in terms of anti-gravity and UFOs and the pyramids. He was watched quite closely by the Air Force and the Defense Intelligence Agency. Then through the 70s, we have these revelations from Kehoe. So it very much sounds like an ongoing program to understand levitation, with a lot of the impetus and inspiration actually coming from, you know, the theories as to how the pyramids were built. That's how they were, you know, taking their inspiration from these ancient legends.
Thank you. Those are great responses. And, you know, Nick, I appreciate your discussion as well of Dr. Robert Oppenheimer's interest in the Mahabharata, and particularly the passages noted in the Kurukshetra War regarding these epic battles with Vimanas and weapons of apparently very advanced technological nature. Mm-hmm. And, you know, interestingly, Nick, among the friends I made while living in the D.C. area was a brilliant young individual from Mumbai who, in dinner conversation with other friends, immediately recognized the significance of the Vimana term. Fascinating discussion in your book.
Yeah, this is sort of a very, probably one of the most controversial chapters in the book, because it deals with the potential existence of you know, maybe going back on a number of occasions, civilizations kind of similar to ours, you know, not necessarily on a worldwide basis, possibly sort of localized, highly advanced civilizations that flourished and destroyed themselves, you know, on maybe on one landmass, you know, the stories like Atlantis, where you had this highly advanced culture where at a time when other parts of the world were still very primitive. So, you know, we're not sure if we're talking about worldwide cultures, but certainly, you know, localized civilizations that, as I said, may have flourished and whether through war or natural cataclysm got destroyed, and now they're just part of our folklore. And one of these stories, in a roundabout way, actually links with ancient nuclear warfare and possibly with people involved in the development of atomic weaponry in our era. And basically, a lot of this goes back to very well-known and sort of very sacred Indian texts, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. Now, the Mahabharata basically deals with this war called the Kurukshetra War. Now, this reportedly took place in a northern part of India called Haryana. Now, as far as the time frame of when this war occurred, conservative estimates are sort of estimate around about 6,000 BC, so this would be sort of around about 8,000 years ago. But there are other experts who believe that the Mahabharata, based on an even older book, you know, possibly even going back like 20, 30, 40,000 years. If that was true, you know, that would require a total revision of, you know, the beliefs and theories as to when mankind actually started to, you know, become a civilized entity, if you like. But nevertheless, you know, the stories do suggest maybe it goes even back even further. Now, you would imagine that, you know, if there was a war in northern India tens of thousands of years ago, your natural instinct would be to imagine a war, you know, fought on horseback and horses and chariots and spears, bows and arrows, shields and swords, that kind of thing. But the Mahabharata talks about a very different war. It almost sounds like a modern-day war. For example, in the translated account from the original Indian text, it talks about how the war was fought with these fast-flying vehicles in the sky known as Vimanas, which were supposedly powered and fueled by a Mercury engine, you know, literally an engine. And, you know, they don't sound even like rudimentary, you know, balloons or gliders or anything like that. You know, they sound like the equivalent of sort of Top Gun aircraft. And they were supposedly armed, you know, with these deadly sort of iron rods, if you like, or pillars that would be let loose from the Vimanas, and, you know, when they would hit the cities, the opposing force, you know, the city would be obliterated in a flash, the ground would move and heave, you know, there would be this massive, bright flash, there'd be this huge plume of column of smoke, which would go, you know, miles into the sky and loom ominously for weeks. The sky would turn black because of all the sort of dirt and dust thrown up into the atmosphere, the temperature would drop, and in the immediate hours after and days after the explosion occurred, the soldiers and people who lived there started to die off. Now, all of this, you know, from the explosion to this sort of huge plume of smoke to the sky going black and the temperature dropping, all that sounds like an atomic explosion because, you know, we've all seen what an atomic explosion looks like, you know, in old film reels, etc. But the issue of the sky going black and the temperature dropping, that's actually a scenario that many theorists and investigators of, you know, the idea of what would happen in a real worldwide nuclear war, billions of tons of dust would be thrown into the atmosphere, which would actually settle there and blot out the sun. And we'd have what's called a nuclear winter, where the temperature drops massively, you know, and there'd be whole die-offs of animals or and pets. But of course, this entire issue, as well as soldiers dying in the hours and days afterwards, that's like a classic example of radiation poisoning. You know, it's like, God forbid it happens, but, you know, if there was a nuclear explosion in New York tomorrow, and, you know, you were half a mile from the blast site and you managed to survive in your house, well, if your windows are blown open, you know, you could find yourself 4 hours after the blast, even though it didn't hit you, you know, you start vomiting, you start passing blood, you know, and by the next day you're dead. You know, your body's just suffered from the effects of radiation poisoning, you know, and just your body is destroyed. So that's what this sounds like. Now, what's more interesting, or equally of interest, is that one person who was absolutely fascinated by the Mahabharata and also the Ramayana was Robert Oppenheimer, the arguably, you know, the brains behind the development of the atomic bomb. Now, of course, in warfare, there were only ever two atomic bombs ever being used, you know, the two that were dropped on Japan, which brought to end the Second World War. And prior to those two, there was one atomic bomb test at a place called the Trinity Site in New Mexico, which occurred just before, you know, they dropped the ones on Japan. And the reason why there was a test bomb in New Mexico is because it sounds a little bit crazy today, but nobody really knew what the first bomb or what any bomb was going to actually be. A bit of smoke and a bang and all their theories would be wrong. Or there were even theories, you know, could it destroy the planet? Nobody really knew, so they just decided to explode one in the deserts of New Mexico and see, kept their fingers crossed that it would be a big explosion, but not too big. But then, of course, you know, there were the two follow-ups on Japan and the war came to an end. Well, Oppenheimer actually came to regret developing the atomic bomb, and that was one of the reasons why he was eventually, in the early 50s, basically thrown out of the project and lost his top secret clearance with the government, because he began to feel that he kind of felt like Dr. Frankenstein, you know, he created a monster, that's how he felt. But what was interesting is that Oppenheimer, as I said, was fascinated by these stories that sounded like ancient nuclear warfare. And he was at a symposium in D.C. in the early 50s, and one of the audience members said to him, you know, was the test bomb in New Mexico and the two bombs dropped on Japan, were they the first atomic bombs ever used? And Oppenheimer said, yes, they were. And then he paused and added, after a second or two, in modern times, which kind of makes it sound like he was trying to say, in a roundabout way, but without revealing possibly something he'd learned, you know, through his exposure to government secrecy, that yes, they were the first in modern times, but maybe somebody achieved it in the very distant past, destroyed themselves, and all that we have left of them today are sort of tales and stories of ancient cultures that people say, oh, well, that's just nonsense, you know, that's just like stories of Atlantis, we can't believe them, you know. But, you know, it could be the case if these events occurred significantly back in the very fog of time, you know, 30, 40,000 years ago, and they were localized civilizations rather than a worldwide one, which would be more difficult to lose every aspect of it. But a localized one could be obliterated, and there might not be anything left to demonstrate that they were kind of up there with what we've achieved, you know, and that we just write them off as tales of, you know, like sort of folkloric supermen or whatever, you know. But when you look at this entire story from the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, these Vimana aircraft, the troops dying after the explosions, and then Oppenheimer's interest and these weird little comments he made now and again, you know, you have to wonder. You know, it's kind of like the people probably remember the closing scenes in the first original Planet of the Apes movie, where Charlton Heston's character stumbles upon this half-buried Statue of Liberty in the sand, you know, because he's back on Earth thousands of years later when, you know, our civilization today has pretty much been obliterated in an atomic war, you know. So who's to say we are the first, you know?
That's such a haunting scene, and I think very interesting. You know, Nick, too, I also found startling that comment by the Madras University's professor, Ramchandra, I can't pronounce his last name, which alluded to India's contributions to aeronautics in the sense of ancient Indian history as noted in epic literature. It sounds to me as though some Indian academics now may be acknowledging this ancient past with the tremendous technology.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, that's an important factor, Trace, is that, you know, when we have these ancient documents and we can verify, you know, even though we're not sure when they're actually written, whether it was long before, you know, even history suggests, but even 8,000 years ago is a long time. But, I mean, the important thing about all this is that we can, you know, decipher these texts, and it's hard not to, you know, get the deciphering wrong. And, you know, when you actually read what they say, it actually points out, you know, that we're talking about what seems to be an ancient nuclear war. But more importantly, even if you take, you know, the atomic side out of things, you still cannot deny that they're talking about what seems to be fast-moving, high-flying aircraft powered by, you know, some engine. Because they talk about when these Vimanas would take to the sky, you know, there'd be this huge roaring of fire, etc., which kind of sounds like, you know, the back burner and the engines on a plane, you know, on a, or on a, you know, on a passenger plane or a fighter plane. So it, when you read all that, it is very difficult to come away with any sort of notion other than the fact that somebody was describing an aerial battle with highly advanced aircraft. And that's why I think, you know, there's now this sort of like a new appreciation of what the stories say, where people, even, you know, very reputable scholars are saying, well, like, this actually does sound like, you know, a description of aircraft.
Thank you. No, very, very interesting. As well, Nick, I wanted to refer now back to our discussion points about 10 minutes ago. Lily has noted a great question in text, and that is, Nick, which branch would you think of the U.S. military is most involved with UFOs today, the U.S. Air Force or U.S. Navy?
That's actually a good question, because although you would imagine the Air Force would be the most obvious one, because they deal with things that are going on in the air, you know, and we do know that the Air Force had a number of UFO projects over the years. You know, we do see the Navy popping up in these things actually more often than people realize. It's just that a lot of people don't put the threads together, you know, and note their involvement. For example, you know, with Maurice Jessup, you know, he was researching this whole issue of the pyramids having been built, you know, with ancient levitation technology derived from ancient extraterrestrial visitations. But he was grilled, you know, and interrogated and interviewed, not by the Air Force, but by a special weapons division in the Navy. Bruce Cathy, this New Zealand researcher who was doing similar work, he actually complained to the U.S. government that he was accosted in New Zealand by a number of U.S. military guys who basically tried to get him to come with them and, you know, talk about his work. And it turned out that at the same time, there was this U.S. naval ship in the area. You know, so we have little fragments like this that the Navy may actually be quite deeply involved, you know. But because, again, I mean, different arms of the military have their own advanced weapons programs. It's not like, you know, there's a U.S. military weapons, advanced weapons program in the U.S. You know, the Navy has one, the Army has one, you know, the Air Force has one, the CIA has programs to, you know, develop advanced surveillance techniques, the FBI has its own departments to do that. So it's not surprising that different branches of the military would be, you know, have their own files and may not even always share them.
Thank you. That's a very thoughtful response there. And, Nick, you know, I know during this interview we will only be able to cover a small segment of the material presented in your book. Mm. I'd like to note here, though, as well, your great discussion on government agency interest and ESP, remote viewing, and other projects. You present a really fascinating spectrum of people and projects. First of all, you note the pioneering work of Henry, is it Puharich, in ESP?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also that Henry Puharich was invited to the Pentagon in 1952 to address certain Pentagon personnel. I find that very interesting. Also, you discussed the concept of the nine. We had one of our senior researchers, very, very bright fellow, last week, ask in the room what could be the significance of the term nine. And it was supposed to be a group of alleged extraterrestrials, but perhaps this particular scenario might have been engineered?
Yeah, I mean, it may have been a combination of the two. This is a strange story because it basically deals with sort of like an ancient visitation with entities from Sirius, from the star Sirius. And this has been written about, you know, in a number of books, the idea of ancient astronauts coming to the Earth from Sirius, you know, and provoking a lot of our stories and legends, you know, of God, etc., but that may have been misinterpretations. Now, what we do know is that a lot of the people who were writing and research in this area were watched very closely by government agencies. For example, Robert Temple, who wrote a book called The Sirius Mystery, he talked about how elements of both British and American intelligence were watching him over the years, clearly because of his serious findings. And, you know, other people have come forward to talk about it as well. But one of the interesting theories is that possibly there may have been some government manipulation where some of the stories may have been expanded upon by government agencies. The idea being, could, you know, government agencies sort of take some of these real stories and then sort of use them themselves, embroider them to actually cover their own activities? That's to say, you know, sort of develop new techniques, you know, for, I guess, spying on the enemy, sort of written that sort of thing, and actually, you know, claim they developed it when it was actually based on, you know, sort of ancient technologies, or could they even have invented some of these stories as a means to try and manipulate and control the paranormal research community, sort of steer them down one particular ancient astronaut avenue that they fabricated to keep them away from a very real truth about ancient aliens. So, you know, there's a lot of weird angles to this that go beyond just the idea of, you know, were ancient aliens here or not. Some of the stories may have been actually fabricated, you know, not because there was nothing to it, but just to steer people away because they were, somebody was getting too close to the truth. So let's insert a really good story and hope they follow that, because there's nothing to it, you know. It's sort of a good little psychological exercise, I guess.
And, you know, on that same train of thought, I can remember decades back the importance of the psychic Jean Dixon, and mm-hmm. also the books of Ruth Montgomery. She was a journalist. Yeah. She was an excellent author, but, you know, the topics towards the end of her publications tend to focus on the conjectured civilizations of Atlantis and Mu. Her work mm-hmm. seemed to take that trend. Any relationship there between Jean Dixon's and Montgomery's work and perhaps a government interest?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for example, I mean, I talk about in the book that, you know, I actually got official files on Ruth Montgomery through the Freedom of Information Act, you know, which talk about, you know, you quite rightly did a lot of research into things, you know, like psychic powers and, you know, ESP and stuff like that. But equally, in saying that, you know, she was also someone who, quite rightly, as you said also, was involved in analyzing and researching ancient mysteries. And, you know, I got hold of her FBI file, which makes it very clear, you know, that her family were deeply following the what she was saying and, you know, talking about people being reincarnated from, you know, Egyptians and things like that. And, you know, again, this demonstrates, not once more like with George Van Tassel and Maurice Jessop, not just investigating the mysteries, but actually keeping a close watch on the people who are researching them as well. For example, when it comes to Ruth Montgomery, one of the things that was specifically of interest to the government was when she wrote a story called, I think it was called Spying by Mind Reading, or Mind Bending, which appeared in the New York Journal American newspaper in 1960. And this dealt with how she'd supposedly been told of some of the US government's early research into sort of psychic phenomena and early remote viewing programs, during which in some of these programs, someone like a spontaneous trance where they were, their spirit, if you like, was suddenly flung back to ancient Egypt, and they even talked about seeing these levitating stones and things like that. So, you know, that shows another aspect of the government interest as well, watching the researchers as well as researching the mysteries themselves.
Well, you know, Nick, on that vein, we have an interesting question coming in from our researcher, Julsa. And Julsa is wondering, Nick, that it has been said in the 50s when some people said that they were abducted and flown around the universe, mm-hmm. some of these people might actually have been government plants mm-hmm. in an effort to make real abductees look incompetent. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I do, actually, and I do believe that is the case. I think two things have happened with regard to the government and UFOs, real UFOs, I mean. I mean, I think some UFOs are military craft, but in terms of the real UFO phenomenon, what I think is that there are genuine encounters, but I think occasionally, perhaps not, they don't need to do it that often, you know, because the word begins to spread, but I think there are a few examples where the government has actually staged UFO incidents to try and instill one scenario over another. For example, there are stories about some of the early contactees. Because some of their stories were a bit outlandish, there are theories that maybe they were people who were sort of inserted into the UFO movement to try and make it look ridiculous and sort of overwhelm the more credible down-to-earth stories with a lot of some stories, of like fanciful stories about taking a trip to Venus, you know, with these sort of long-haired aliens or whatever. You know, it would actually be a good ploy that if you need to keep the lid on a really serious UFO presence, well, make fun of it by having these eccentric characters become even more popular. So, but that doesn't take away the fact that if the government is creating and fabricating UFO incidents, it's clearly being done for a reason, and all the evidence points to trying to confuse the truth about the real aspect of the phenomenon, and that's an important thing, you know, we shouldn't forget.
Well said. And, you know, Nick, I wanted to reference as well that among the many segments that we really won't be able to get to in detail this evening, you have a great section on Mars and the controversy over possible markers of a very ancient civilization, past civilization, Mars. You give a great deal of information regarding the July 76 NASA Viking 1 images, also the later images, 1998 and 2001, from the Mars Global Surveyor craft, and later, the year later, I believe, the Mars Odyssey probe. And it's just a wonderful discussion on the face on Mars, also those that believe there's actually a city complex shown, on the writings and research of Mac Tawney's, as well as Richard Hoagland and astronomer Tom Van Flandern. Very, very interesting reading.
Oh, thanks a lot. Thanks, Trace.
Also, and I hope it's not getting to other points we probably won't have a chance to get to tonight, is an interesting discussion on perhaps the actual aspect or some evidence of a Project Blue Beam. And then in a totally different vein, you go into the interesting controversial subjects on the Middle East, whether or not there was a possible Stargate in the ancient area of what was Sumer, and that is it called Uruk, U-R-U-K area. A great deal of interesting discussion on that.
Well, thanks. You know, I tried to cover as much area, you know, and bring sort of new information to the table of documents, because I think, you know, it's one of these areas that, although a lot of books have been written on ancient astronauts, there hasn't really been a book written on what the government knows about it. And that was sort of one of the criteria I always sort of look for when writing a book, is to be able to give the reader something totally new. So hopefully, you know, it offers the government insight into, you know, the whole ancient astronauts angle.
And, you know, as well, you give the reader a great deal of pause for thought on just might be the motivation on government interest. It sounds very plausible, for example, to gain vital information on what concepts could prove useful for important technological and even military advances. Also to understand past civilizations, if they did indeed exist on this planet, and also a cosmic thread potential, as well as to correct the historical record.
Yeah, I think all those issues come into play. You know, there's clearly interest in trying to determine if sort of the powers of the ancients could be weaponized, you know, for the present and the future, whether particularly things like levitation and, you know, acoustic technology being used to destroy things. And unfortunately, you know, that's what the military is in the business of, is, you know, developing weapons, and that's certainly, they were looking at the past for inspiration in some cases, but also, you're quite right, you know, trying to determine our historical past, you know, that much of which is still shrouded in mystery today. So I think there's a lot of different reasons depending on the era and the relevant agency involved as well.
And, you know, Nick, I can't wait to read your next book. You've had, you've written several excellent books. In each book, I found the information very intriguing, and it's always presented in the style of discovery and adventure. It's
Well, thanks
it's a great impact, and it really produces a great deal of information for the reader. Also, Nick, you're going to be speaking at the Paradigm Symposium mm-hmm. in October. Any other announcements? And, you know, I'd like you to take the show out. We have about a minute left.
Okay. Yeah, well, actually, at that conference, I'll be speaking about this book again. I'll also be speaking on the last Saturday in September at the Austin, Texas-based Austin Center for Spiritual Living, also about this book as well. So, and if people want to contact me, if they go to nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com or nickredfern14.blogspot.com, people can link to Facebook there, and you know, always happy to chat with people, answer questions, and you know, that's sort of the lectures and conferences I've got coming up in the immediate future. So.
Well, definitely worth attending. And Nick, please promise to be a soon return guest. It's always
I'll be happy to.
Lots of information, very, very thought-provoking, and everyone in the room, too, is very appreciative. And I would assume that there are many people in the network. The stats for this will be enormous. Your work is very much admired, very much followed. And at this point, too, I'd like to thank our listeners for joining us this evening. Thank you again, Nick. Great
thanks,
discussion. Chris. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Good night. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us this evening on A Global Focus with guest Nick Redfern. We appreciate your time with us and hope you have a great late summer weekend and upcoming week.